Hello, listener. Dahlia Lithwick here, host of Amicus, that's Slate's podcast on the courts and the law and democracy and the rule of law. This May, our team will be publishing a special project that we are calling How Originalism Ate the Law. This neutral and academic-sounding methodology of looking at the law is, in fact, anything but neutral. Originalism is to the conservative legal movement what peanut butter is to jelly. As we're going to show you over the course of this project, originalism has been both cover and calling for conservative justices and judges to radically overhaul the lives of millions of Americans. And while they claim to be the apolitical interpreters of the Constitution and its authors' intents, they have overturned Roe, radically expanded gun rights, and eviscerated voting rights. Across Slate.com and the Amicus podcast, we're going to be tackling questions like, where did originalism come from? Why has it taken over? Are progressive originalists really a thing? And am I allowed to have an opinion on originalism? Spoiler, the answer to that last question, you are. To celebrate the launch of this big project, we are running a special two-week-long free trial of Slate Plus on Apple Podcasts. As a member, you'll get exclusive episodes from How Originalism Ate the Law, plus ad-free listening to all of your favorite Slate podcasts. Join now by clicking Try Free at the top of the Amicus show page or visit slate.com/amicusplus to get access wherever you listen.
The following podcast contains explicit language.
I'm Julia Turner, and this is the Slate Culture Gabfest, You Will Never Be Enough edition. It's Wednesday, August 22nd, 2018. On today's show, Crazy Rich Asians. The new movie from John Chu is the biggest major studio release with an all-Asian cast since 1993's The Joy Luck Club. We'll discuss. Then, Younger, the TV Land sitcom about a 40-year-old woman passing herself off as a 26-year-old in order to land a job in publishing, is now in its fifth season. I have been a stealth, secret, sly fan, sort of apart from my culture-reviewing capacities on this show, and now we've yoinked it into the subject of discussion. Finally, we ask the question, what's the deal with Elon Musk? We want to talk about him as a cultural figure, which he is. Steve and Dana are both on vacation. I am back, but I am here with the host of Slate's Shakespeare and Politics podcast, Lend Me Your Ears, Isaac Butler.
Hi, Julia.
Welcome. I'm so excited to have you on the show. We should probably promise listeners that we won't talk for 50 minutes uninterrupted about the finer points of Measure for Measure, which is what we did the last time we shared a podcast studio.
Indeed.
But it could happen. And making her Culture Gabfest co-hosting debut, Ingu Kang.
Hi.
Hello. So glad to have you here. Let us begin by discussing the movie Crazy Rich Asians. It's based on the book by Kevin Kwan, which I believe I've endorsed that book series on this show, and stars Constance Wu, Henry Golding, Michelle Yeoh, Awkwafina, among many, 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 many others. Directed by John Chu, much has been written about this movie's groundbreaking cast and now box office success, some by our own Ingu Kang. Before we dig into the movie, let's listen to a clip.
Singapore, for spring break. Colin's wedding. We've been dating for over a year now, and I think it's about time people met my beautiful girlfriend. Come on. I'm Colin's best man. Don't you want to see where I grew up? Meet my family? My ama? I meet up with that strange college roommate of yours.
Caitlin.
Mm-hmm.
She has been begging me to come visit her, you know.
The universe has spoken. It wants you over there. Come to Singapore. I want the whole island to meet the brilliant Rachel Chu.
All right. Well, that clip gives us a whole bunch of expository setup and not a ton of Constance Wu, America's new sweetheart, the star of this film. You hear just her glancing voice there. But let's begin with our critic, Ingu. You reviewed the film for us. Please tell us what you thought of it.
I really adore this movie. It is very much an Asian American translation of Kevin Kwan's book, which I think is really interested in parsing out the different sources of wealth and the different desirabilities of different types of wealth in China. and Singapore, specifically how Singaporean wealth relates to, I guess, like the nouveau riche of China. And a lot of it is sort of about how old money in Singapore is superior to new money in China, which is not as present in the movie, because it's a story about an Asian American woman who goes to Asia, discovers she is not the same type of Asian as the people that she encounters, and then realizes through these different forms of cultural and economic alienation that she is actually quite proud of where she comes from, and realizes she doesn't need to do any overcompensating to deserve the hand of her boyfriend, who is very, very rich.
Yeah, he's like a Singaporean Prince Charming, essentially.
And a dreamboat.
Also a dreamboat. Lots of dreamboats. Basically, everybody in this movie is a dreamboat.
And if you like abs, this is the movie for you.
One thing that this movie does is sexualize Asian men, like, very explicitly, in a way that Hollywood does not always take the time to do. It's interesting, I think, to watch a romantic comedy that's like a nice, bright, buoyant, well-made, charming, delightful romantic comedy, and experience it also freighted with so many of the expectations of being such an unusual film for Hollywood, in that it is so full of Asian characters of all kinds. And so you see a lot of beefcake, and then you think about the meaning of the beefcake, which is like maybe a lot to put on this movie that is like a charming rom-com based on a compelling and slightly goofy book series. Isaac, what did you make of the film?
So, yeah, I mean, it's interesting that you brought that up, because one of the things that I wrote is burden of expectations in my notebook and underlined it a few times. And I do think that it is too bad that due to, well, frankly, Hollywood racism and the long gap between this film and The Joy Luck Club, that it cannot sort of, in our discourse, that, you know, it can't only be a delightful August sort of princess fantasy rom-com-y film. Like, there's sort of like a lot more kind of surrounding it. That said, I mean, like, I enjoyed the movie quite a bit. I have a Malaysian Chinese family that grew up in Singapore. I've been to Singapore a few times. It was really great to see the hawker markets and the durian on the back of the trucks and hear Singlish, and, you know, that, you know, brought back a lot of memories of a certain time of my life as well. And I really appreciated the cultural specificity of it. I don't know that I think it's like the greatest rom-com I've ever seen or anything like that. But I also don't think it needs to be. I don't think it should be. I enjoyed it, and that was enough.
I want to say a couple of things about the rom-com factor, actually, because I think something that we're kind of dancing around is how white most romantic comedies actually are. I think if we're thinking about the staples of the genre, they're very much about a heterosexual white couple. And any sort of deviation from that seems to be almost as like calculation or a compensation for that type of depiction and all that it leaves out. I think this idea that Asian people can be vulnerable and fall in love and want and be lovable is like weirdly radical.
Yeah, I thought that passage from your review was so smart and so well put. And I think one thing this movie reminded me of, I mean, if you think about the various heartening steps for representation in Hollywood in the last few years, the movie that this reminded me the most of is Wonder Woman more than Get Out. And I'm here, you know, it's obviously sort of ridiculous to lump all of these movies together at all, but I do think they have in common the fact that they are stories that Hollywood might not have told 10 years ago, where it skips the tortured set of steps that often happen in Hollywood, where the movie is about the fact that it is putting an Asian character in a place where it might not be. It's not an interracial romance between an Asian person and a white person that explicitly interrogates the question of expectations of Asian, like, it just dispenses with that whole step, like the driving Miss Daisy step in representation of here's how you get a figure who's not usually on screen by giving a white point of entree, and just leapfrogs forward to be a movie that has no white characters in it. There's a set piece at the beginning in which there are a few white actors and there are a few white kind of sex pot ornaments at a bachelor party. And other than that, there's almost no white speaking roles and no white character scene. And it just immediately does the act of representation that's been missing. And it reminded me of the moment in Wonder Woman where you see Gal Gadot physically rescue Chris Pine. And you're just like, why have I never seen a woman be strong in that way? Like it doesn't. The freighting is tacit rather than explicit. It's subtext rather than text. And I think that's part of what makes this feel so powerful. So even though you're just buoyed along enjoying the romantic comedy, which we should also stipulate, independent of questions of ethnicity, romantic comedies are an endangered species at this point. So it's also just pleasant at the end of summer for one of the big, highly anticipated movies to be a Cinderella romance in and of itself. And then you get to feel this pleasure of how fresh and exciting it is to experience this familiar form, if less used now form, in an entirely different landscape.
The one thing about it that I thought, though, as I was watching it, was that there is a way in which I do think the movie, like, you have to buy into the appeal of having that much wealth on some level. Do you know what I mean? Like, you have to sort of be, she's a little seduced by it as well as trying to navigate it at the same time, right? That's one of the things that's going, how do I put this? There was a part of me that was not along for that part of the journey. I don't know that sort of the kind of, overabundant riches of it, which is right there in the title. I mean, don't get me wrong. Do you know what I mean? That I wasn't like 100% on board for that. So while I enjoyed it, there was a part where, like, sometimes I felt like, shouldn't someone roll their eyes at this? Like, and part of it was the audience I saw it with. Like, when they got to the wedding, there's a wedding, someone singing a kind of very beautiful cover of Only Fools Rush In.
It's actually Kina Granis, who is a extremely famous Asian American YouTuber.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah, I wrote about a bunch of little Easter eggs for an Asian American audience, also for Slate.
What was really fascinating was there was like a divide in the audience I saw it with between people who thought the elaborateness of the wedding was ridiculous and were laughing at it, and people who found it unbelievably moving and were, you know, tearing up at it. And I felt both of those impulses at the same time. I don't know. I had an odd experience of the actual, like, the richness of it.
I feel like a lot of romantic comedies are extremely dependent on ideas of affluence. I think, you know, Nancy Meyers and her beautiful, beautiful kitchens have been a cultural punchline for at least a decade now for a reason. I kind of find the criticism that, like, the movie is not socialist or Marxist enough in its evaluation of Asia to be a little bizarre. The movie is obviously about that kind of class alienation that, like, Rachel feels. And I think that if you were going to say from a character point of view that Rachel, as an economics professor, should maybe be more worried about income inequality in Singapore, I think that would be one thing. But to fault the movie for this is a little annoying to me, because it's about a middle-class Asian Americans encounter with the hyper rich, and that's just what the story is.
Yeah.
So
yeah, I mean, I don't necessarily think it's a problem with the movie. It's just something that affected my reaction to it. You are, like I said, it's right there in the title. You're absolutely correct. It's the given circumstances of the film. I just in the same way that I sometimes find myself looking at those Nancy Meyers kitchens and being like, "Oy, this kitchen," you know, like I had a kind of similar, you know, one step remove from the film at some of those moments. It is absolutely core to what the movie is doing that it do that. I completely agree with you about that. I don't need the movie to have a Marxist, like a Brechtian moment where a character turns to the audience and has a Marxist critique of old money in Singapore, for sure.
I would love for us to pause briefly to celebrate Constance Wu's performance before we wrap up, because I definitely walked out of the movie just saying the phrase Constance Wu is America's sweetheart, Constance Wu is America's sweetheart, Constance Wu is America's sweetheart over and over and over in my head. Like, I just want it to be the 90s and for her to be the star of every romantic comedy and for them to only make romantic comedies anymore. Like, I am ready for her to fall in love with an architect. I'm ready for her to fall in love with the coach of the opposing basketball team. I'm ready for her to fall in love as a scientist in Antarctica who's working with a guy at the North Pole. Like, I'm so here for Constance Wu, and I recognize that I just never watched Fresh Off the Boat and I'm an idiot and I'm late to the party, but can you guys just like join me in the cavil for a minute?
Absolutely. I mean, she's unbelievably charismatic and funny and a very, very dynamic actor with a wide range. And I hope we start seeing her in everything.
For all that I would have loved to see Crazy Rich Asians adapted into an unending TV show, because the world Kwan makes is so rich, it could support like a gajillion episodes forever, I think. It's really exciting to see Wu get the star turn. Before we move on to Younger, let's do the business. Isaac, what have we got this week?
Well, first up, tickets are still available for Slate Day, a live podcast experience produced in connection with the Texas Tribune Festival. Join Slate's politically minded shows, the Political Gabfest, Trumpcast, Amicus, El Gabfest, and The Gist. Slate Day will take place at the Capitol Factory in downtown Austin, Texas on Saturday, September 29th, in partnership with the Texas Tribune Festival. This is an intimate venue with limited seating, so go to slate.com/live for tickets and information. In Slate Plus today, we're going to be talking about the movies you see on airplanes. What movies do you like to watch either on your own screen or over the shoulder of the person next to you on a plane? And to hear segments like that and to get ad-free podcasts, sign up for Slate Plus. Slate Plus is our membership program and is a great way to support us. For just $35 for your first year, you can help cover the cost of producing the Culture Gabfest and your other favorite Slate shows. And of course, in return, you'll get extended ad-free versions of this show and other great Slate podcasts and a ton of other great benefits. So, if you'd like to support the Culture Gabfest, go to slate.com/cultureplus and join Slate Plus today. Okay, let's go.
Younger is a sitcom on TV Land starring Sutton Foster as a divorced mother in her 40s, pretending to be in her late 20s in order to land a job in publishing, a world she left 15 years prior to raise a family. The show leans heavily on Sutton Foster's charms, gives her one 26-year-old boyfriend and one 40-something boyfriend, ruthlessly and with surprising accuracy and subtlety satirizes the media moment, naming proper names. It features heavily some Sex and the City DNA in creator Darren Star and costume designer Patricia Field, and has weirdly been my guilty pleasure TV show, like what I watch when I'm watching something that I'm not watching to discuss on this show. So now you guys are taking my undiscussable favorite thing to watch into the territory of discussability. Let's listen to a clip.
I worked at Random House for 3 years. I started as an assistant to a marketing VP, and then I worked my way up to junior editor.
Wow, impressive.
At the time, I was one of the youngest people ever to make editor. I was 25.
I'm 25.
Don't worry, you don't look a day over 7.
And then for the past, what, 15 years, nothing?
I quit to raise my child, Caitlin, who's now spending her senior year in an exchange program in India. Look, I know I've been out of play for a while, but I am a much smarter, more capable person today than I was 15 years ago.
I'm sure.
I'm ready to throw myself back into work 24/7. I'm ready to pick up where I left off.
Well, it has been quite a long hiatus, Liza. Things have changed.
Facebook, Twitter, iPhones.
iPads, ebooks, YouTube.
Instagram, Snapchat, Skype.
Pinterest.
Bang with friends.
Seriously? You bang with friends?
It's way better than Tinder.
So, Julia, you mentioned earlier that it was one of your guilty pleasures, and I'm curious about what makes it a guilty pleasure.
Ugh, I don't know why I said that, because I don't even believe in guilty pleasures. I think I draw a line in my personal culture consumption between things I am watching with a critical eye to consider how we might discuss them on this show, or cover them in Slate, or whether they might prompt ideas I should pop into a Slate channel to get someone to do something about. And I have a very limited set of media experiences that aren't work. Like, it's very rare for me to read anything in any form of media that doesn't make me think, like, oof, we should have hired that person, or we should have signed a piece about that, or we should, you know, let's like the real estate section and Law and Order reruns and everything else is like a little bit work. And for some reason, I had classed this show as not work. I think, honestly, because of snobbery about its auspices, like TV Land, Hilary Duff. you know, this is like a bonbon. We've got all this prestige TV and everybody's dying left, right, and center. And I'm just going to like sneak off to the side since they canceled Bunheads and hang out with Sutton Foster and Hilary Duff. Like, I think I thought maybe it was like a, you know, an updated Disney show or something, like High School. I don't even know what Hilary Duff was in. Anyway, however, it's basically the successor to Sex and the City, which love or hate Sex and the City. It is a show about sex, work, and womanhood that is very plugged into extremely current cultural questions and uses the mechanics of this publishing house rather than the mechanics of Carrie's dubious sex advice column to as an entree to be extremely topical and have all sorts of thinly veiled stand-ins for actual current media celebrities, and thus to be really up to date about all of our preoccupations, have pretty smart and with it nods to those questions. Although fundamentally the point, I mean, it's a 22-minute comedy, like that it always moves briskly on from whatever idea is raised by the book pitch that week to like which of the guys is Liza really in love with and what's going to happen and who's she lying to this week and what are the moral stakes based on that. But yeah, I misjudged it. Like I don't believe in guilty pleasures. I did file it briefly as not work, but that was stupid because I think it's a really smart show. That is what I meant by that.
If we're going to push that Sex and the City comparison further, I think it is worth noting that it is an extremely white version of New York City. Although I guess you can also make the argument that publishing itself is a very white industry. But I thought that was worth noting. That said, I love this show. I love this show so much. And I wanted to write about it because I think that this is one of those shows that gets classified as women's entertainment. And because it's a lighthearted tone, it doesn't get the kind of serious treatment that a lot of more prestige-seeming but honestly less interesting shows. So the piece that I wrote about it for Slate was about how this show, in the first half of the current season, which is the fifth season, how it tackles Me Too in its like own very specific way. And I thought that was a very good example of how the show takes on heavy topics with a lightness of tone, but also a surprising emotional sensitivity to how it affects the characters.
Emotional sensitivity and moral seriousness, I think. It's like a 22-minute bonbon that has like a real moral backbone, which is part of what part of why I can, you know, just lightly flit among these thorny questions and yet not feel like it's brainlessly exploiting them to seem with it or something.
Yes. And I think you could maybe accuse the first season, which relied on a lot more jokes about like, oh, millennials, they're so kooky. there were probably one too many of those jokes in the first season. But the first season of Sex and the City was also quite bad.
I mean, one thing that I think has been really nice about the show is characters who were any character who initially presents as an obstacle or a kind of figure to be lied to and put one over upon just inevitably gets 3D printed into a really interesting character. Even the daughter who sort of like appears on Skype from her year in India like a couple times in season one is now like a character who shows up in scenes and has her own emotional dilemmas, and like just no part of the pig is wasted in this show. Like any little sideways figment of a character who turns up ends up becoming like a pretty rich part of the whole. Isaac, you are not a pre-existing watcher.
I'm not
of this
a pre-existing
show.
Watcher of the show.
Tell which us was, what you made of it.
Well, first of all, I should say that one of my favorite things about it. I have mixed feelings about the show, but one of my favorite things about it is also there's like lots of really great musical theater actors in it. So Sutton
it's shot
Foster,
here. It's very New York. Yeah.
Sutton Foster, Miriam Shore, Jane Krakowski, Kristen Chenoweth. It's like really. I just love seeing all those folks. I like seeing them on stage. I like seeing them on my television. The show that it also reminded me of, and I say this as someone who's seen every episode of Sex and the City and likes Sex and the City, but the show it also reminded me of is The Good Wife, which is also a show about someone who has, marital troubles and reenters the workforce that has changed and is sort of trying to navigate that as a woman. She does not masquerade as 26 years old, but, and that tries to stay on top of what's going on in politics and culture in this kind of joking way with a lot of analogs to contemporary things.
So what you're saying
humor.
Is I should watch The Good Wife, which I never did.
Oh, I didn't know that. I will also, and I should just say my favorite little publishing wink they have is P is for Pigeon, the parody of H is for Hawk. And I loved, Ingo, I thought your piece did a really great job of articulating like all sorts of things that the show is doing that are interesting. I will just say, I do not find the line-to-line writing particularly funny. But like often I just don't find the jokes all that funny. And so, I don't know why that is, but so there's a way in which I'm like, I feel like I should be laughing more in something that is a 22-minute comedy on TV and not one of those prestige sad comedies where the point is that you feel bad and don't laugh at all, but one in which you are supposed to be laughing, and there is a weird thing about its rhythms. I mean, Julia, you noted that it does this really great job of lightly skipping on top of things and that there's a lot going on in each episode. But part of what that means, and because I had to marathon a lot of it, before this episode, is that each scene is also quite short. They're like 4 to 8 lines, and like there's an immediate plot. There's either an immediate plot development, an exposition dump, or a setup and a punchline for a joke, and then they move on, right? And there was something about seeing that rhythm over and over and over again over the course of 4 days that became very difficult for me to take. I think if I was watching it once a week, I would enjoy it a lot more than I wound up doing.
That's so interesting. I agree that I don't watch the show for its comedy, and I also think the sort of split in television shows with the idea that like if it's 40 to 60 minutes it's a drama, and if it's 20 to 30 minutes it's a comedy, which is like such a given of making television and sort of invisible to like a lot of watchers of TV, is just ludicrous. Like this would make total sense as a 40 minute network drama that was sort of like a light love story, like A Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. I mean, it's
or The Good Wife. The Good Wife's very funny. It's billed as a drama because it's 45 minutes, but it's mostly comedic.
Right. So I definitely would agree. Like, I don't watch this for the jokes. It's not Veep. It's not 30 Rock. It's full of knowing cultural references, but they're really just used to give you a little bit of something to like wink at and recognize as you watch the plot unfold. The Hilary Duff character is publishing the book of and entangled currently with a Pod Save America Monkey figure, and like that's sort of amusing. It's not hilarious. He's kind of smug and self-regarding in a way that is amusing but not jokesy.
I think the show that it also reminds me of other than Sex and the City is actually Friends, and I know that Friends is a lightning rod for a lot of people for many good reasons. But I think that one of the things that this show does really well is that it's a really great romantic comedy spread out across many different seasons. And there's a serialized element to that romantic comedy that I think works incredibly well. Right now, I guess really for most of the show, Liza has been caught between the 20-something boyfriend that she first got when she moved back to New York City and her boss, who is the head of the publishing company where she works, who is obviously a much more stately sort of man, but with like a really good heart, of course. But I think that the way that they have played off that love triangle, especially with Charles, the publisher's really complicated relationship with his ex-wife, and their drawn-out divorce makes the show really feel like it has weight rather than just being another analog to Bella and Edward and Jacob.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think it's that same 3D printing quality. Like, they developed the two relationships you would develop if you were, like, sketching this out on a board for season one. All right, let's give her a boyfriend for her young self and a better boyfriend for her true older self. And, like, she'll be torn between them. But they're real, and those relationships are, like, enriching and deepening, and both of the men keep returning, like, you know, it's like the sun and the moon. They just keep, like, coming back in the life, and she keeps being torn between them. But, like, you're not bored of them, and the question of whether she should be with it, they just do. They're doing such good work making this light thing tick, and I've come to really admire a lot about it. And I think, you know, your point about race is really smart, Ingu, and I think it speaks to the way in which this show has been classified. Like, in some ways, the world that it's set in is extremely similar to the world of Girls, right? It's aspiring
right.
white literary people, and a depiction of the world they're in, which is whiter than a cross-section of New York broadly. And the set of arguments about that show and its depictions of race and how it approached them and how it modified its approach over time happened because people took that show seriously and, like, thought it was an important show with important things to say and thus should not just, like, whiff on this huge insignificant issue. And this show, I think, is given a little bit of a pass on that front because everybody's, or too many people like me, have classed it wrongly as not worth serious consideration. So let us all watch Younger, take it more seriously, except maybe Isaac, who doesn't love the jokes. All right, our final topic today, is this If Then, Slate's technology podcast? No, it's not. Is this Slate Money, Slate's podcast on financial markets and the corporations that move our industries? No, it is not. Are we Slate's culture podcast? And do we reckon with the cultural titans that infiltrate our minds and shape our view of the world? Yes, it is. And that is why we are talking about Elon Musk as a cultural figure. Is he a genius? Is he Einstein? Is he a Bond villain? Is he having a breakdown? What do we make of our cultural fascination with Elon Musk as he presents right now? Isaac, do you have a theory of Elon Musk?
I'm not sure I exactly have a theory of him. I do have a theory about the appeal of this particular moment, which is to say that, you know, there are these, you know, particularly tech titans who bestride our narrow world like a colossus, and it's really fun to watch them slip on a banana peel and fall on their face, right? And that part of the cultural thing is that once someone has attained that much power, we are looking for the moment where they start to have their downfall. And whether I doubt this is Elon Musk's downfall, right? But there, you can sense this, like, slavering hunger for that. And he appears to be, the only theory I could say is that he does appear to be, like, a deeply odd person, right? Maybe something like the person he named his car company after, maybe something of a megalomaniac. What I found interesting, particularly in the readings we were doing this for this episode, which I didn't really know much about, is his incredibly passionate, almost religious fan base was, I think, the thing that I found really interesting about him as this figure, that he has attracted, you know, this sort of extreme fan base that will defend him in these incredibly ugly ways online. I mean, I guess everything does nowadays, but because I don't follow the tech world that much, I was like, really? A tech entrepreneur has, you know, like a really, you know, John Locke conspiracy-esque fan base? You know, that was really fascinating to me.
Ingu, you're a West Coast correspondent. You're proximate to Silicon Valley, the Bay Area, at least from where we sit. What's your purchase on Elon? Do you have a grand unified theory of Elon Musk?
He should probably spend less time at Burning Man, I think, is what I think. I think it's great that there's this sort of like one particular branch of tech billionaireism, whose whole thing is to reap the rewards of social progress and then also cast themselves as these really accomplished businessman. And he's obviously following in the footsteps of Steve Jobs and putting himself out in the world as this hyper-successful, hyper-capitalist prophet from the future. And there's clearly a backlash against giant tech companies right now in the culture. And I think that part of the backlash against Elon Musk is symptomatic of that larger backlash with regard to YouTube and Facebook and all of those things. And part of it is just that, you know, there is sometimes a really thin line between a visionary and a crackpot. And when you don't deliver on these profits that you promise, people are going to start looking at you more as a crackpot than a visionary.
Yeah. Tori Bosch, who edits our Future Tense section, has a theory that I believe she refers to as the crackpot line, you know, being the Future Tense section. It's about technology in the future and sort of the kind of policy and politics surrounding it. And basically, she says every single futurist, every person who's obsessed with the future can be classified somewhere on the crackpot spectrum. And you just have to make sure they're like on the right side of the line. So I think that is the exact framing. I think Elon Musk's appeal is super fascinating. And I think the way my theory of the case is that the way he developed this fan army actually has a lot to do with figures like Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump. I think he has avoided, for all that he is maybe seen as symptomatic of broader tech trends and that a brewing backlash against him might be indicative of a growing set of concerns about the power that tech companies have over our lives. He's very different. Like, he's a very different figure from Zuckerberg. His companies and the companies he's built are very different from these behemoths, Facebook, Amazon, Apple, Google, Netflix. Like, he's the inventor, right? He's not the business guy. He's not the coder. He's an inventor, like a classic, like wild-haired, in the lab, I'm going to solve the problems of society through my powers of scientific invention. I am going to solve society's problems and make a buck doing so. Like, it's a very old American idea. It's a very old capitalist idea. And he uses a language to describe those inventions. He has like a gift for language and plain speech and an avoidance of stultifying jargon that reminds me of how Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump connected with their constituents. Like, the names of his companies, Tesla, which is a little bit veiled, the boring company, for the idea for this company that's just going to bore gigantic tunnels and build infrastructure that it's unclear is the best kind of infrastructure. But hey, he's like, it's funny to call a company the boring company. Yeah. That's going to make a borer. Like, that's a better name than Microsoft, you know,
right.
or Google or Yahoo or Oath. One of the factories where some part of the new, more economical Tesla model is being worked on and made is called the Gigafactory. Why wouldn't you want to go to the Gigafactory instead of like Sector X in Phoenix or whatever they call the fact? You know, like, he just has a gift for appealing to the part of our of technological change that we live in plain language and with clear joy in the excitement of what we're able to build. Like, what he's done with Tesla is amazing. He took the electric car, a sad kind of green, you know, naderish notion that like people in the early aughts thought, oh yeah, maybe someday we won't use gas in our cars, and like built something so dope that it became the status symbol, and people who used to drive Maseratis now want Teslas. Like, that's a thing. Like, it's a thing that exists in the world that he made that didn't used to be there. I don't pretend to understand enough about private space travel and the shift between government and corporate science that is changing the way that we think about outer space and exploring the world to really comment with knowledge on what SpaceX is up to and what it's achieved. But I think he's built his image by capitalizing on being an inventor of stuff, and also stuff, not software, right?
Right.
Objects, shit that does stuff, technology you can see the outcomes of. And then using like vivid, fun language to describe it and name it, and then being a little bit more accessible and personable than some of these other inscrutable and honestly more boring titans.
Something I found really fascinating is that a couple of weeks ago, I was talking about Elon Musk with my husband, who is basically works in an engineering adjacent field and is a huge evangelist for science and all of the marvels that science can do. And I was making some sort of broad generalization about science people, specifically white men in science. And I used Elon Musk as an example. And my husband immediately just like completely shifted moods and said, Elon Musk is not a science person. He is a capitalist. Mm-hmm. And I thought that was very interesting as someone, as coming from someone who reveres science, because I think in his view, all of the stuff that you were just talking about is so much more related to marketing and sort of like selling what science might be able to do, as opposed to largely making them and then being practical for mass usage. I think if anything, the person or character that Elon Musk really reminds me of is Lee Pace's character in the great TV show Halt and Catch Fire, who is this guy who is able to harness people's wonder in a Don Draper-ish way, but about technology, but also doesn't have like the follow through necessary to make this a reality, especially for especially for mass consumption.
Yeah, well, I think that's part of the salesman quality that I was talking about with the Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump comparisons. There is some virtue, I think, actually in that seer role, like in actually making something happen, making it real, making it feel like, oh, of course we can have electric cars. Of course cars are going to be electric. Like that is a thing that I think a lot of people feel now that they didn't feel before, that they didn't feel merely at the arrival of the Nissan Leaf. Like, it may be that the glamour of the Tesla is stupid, and that's a stupid thing to be a persuasive force in the world, but the salesmanship is not empty, I think. Like, it's effective. It's interesting that you compare him to that Lee Pace character, because the other character that Elon Musk reminds me of a lot right now is Kanye West, in that there is a prominent person associated with excellence who has produced many things that have changed the way people think about whole fields of endeavor, who has always run a little bit hot and like closer to the bone and maybe been a little bit less guarded in their public communications than someone of their excellence and stature typically is, which is a big part of their appeal and part of how they build a fan base. And then that person begins to publicly appear a little bit more unstable and unhealthy and confused than they've seen at previous moments in their career. And you feel like you're watching some kind of celebrity crack up, and you feel yucky about it, and also not necessarily entirely, you know, sympathetic, and also like it's of a piece with a whole bunch of self-aggrandizing bullshit that never seemed particularly great in the first place. But now maybe you have to reclassify some of that as connected to, you know, I mean, we can't really know what someone's actual mental health situation is, but
right,
because of the thin membrane between figures like this and the rest of us, you feel privy to something that maybe you shouldn't be privy to.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I feel like there's a way in which, you know, great salesmen, and I think Elon Musk, like the Lee Pace character in Halt and Catch Fire, right? He's like an incredible, or Don Draper is an incredible salesman. There's also like a vein of charlatanism within that, right? Like that is part of how that seems to work. And so, you know, you have Elon Musk selling himself as this sort of brilliant, not only inventor, but businessman, but actually his companies rely heavily on government subsidies, and Tesla would never make money without the U.S. taxpayer, right? Or you have this guy who seems to be able to do everything, but then we see these chinks in his armor, like he calls a guy who helped rescue the Thai soccer team a pedophile on Twitter because the guy dared to, you know, criticize him, or he seems to be getting his company in legal trouble by tweeting out what I originally thought was a marijuana themed joke about taking his company private for $4.20 a share, right? So like there is that weird thing where we are starting to see the rich vein of charlatanism that runs within, I think, these sort of famous, you know, inventor, businessman, crackpot, futurist types. Again, I think it's not a coincidence that he named his car company Tesla, right? Tesla himself had a vein of charlatanism and a lot of crackpottery to go in with his futurism. And so it's interesting that we've hit this moment where that is sort of coming to the surface more. He should probably lay off Twitter and take a nap.
I think with regard to Twitter, I think like that messianic self-obsession is so much easier to see these days, or maybe people just have less patience for it when they see the kind of havoc that Donald Trump was able to wreak with that quality and people believing in that. And so I guess to me, it's very unsurprising that the culture or parts of the culture have turned on Elon Musk. Don't know if we have really that much patience anymore for men who promise a lot of things and then never seem to deliver, but sure are really busy writing nonsense on Twitter.
All right. Well, Elon Musk as a cultural figure, I have a feeling he will be with us for some time to come and that we may have opportunities to re-examine. All right. Now is the moment in our show when we endorse. Ingu, what have you got?
I'm going to recommend an article that Allison Wilmore wrote for BuzzFeed. She wrote about Crazy Rich Asians and also a Netflix movie, also with a female Asian American lead called To All the Boys I've Loved Before, which is actually a teen rom-com that I kind of hated. But the article in itself dwells on the issue of Asian American escapism and what that means in the context of generally pretty heavy films and stories about the Asian American experience and what this focus on escapism might mean for where Asian Americans are today. It's, I think, a really incredible and really interesting reframing of Crazy Rich Asians in the context of the romantic comedy, which we've discussed here. But also, there are so many layers to this that I think her piece is really worth reading.
Cool. I'll go check that out.
I love that piece.
Isaac, what's your endorsement?
Well, you know, Crazy Rich Asians, obviously, you know, most of that film takes place in Singapore. And so I thought it would be fun to endorse another story that takes place in Singapore, but a very different story. And that is the incredibly brilliant graphic novel, The Art of Charlie Chan Hock Chai by Sunny Liu, which came out in 2015. And it's a really fascinating book because it sort of poses as kind of a coffee table art book about a fictitious cartoonist. And then within that, and in telling his life story and showing examples of his art, which are, of course, not by him, but by Sunny Liu, the author, it tells the entire story of Singaporean independence and how the democratic dream for Singapore blossomed and then wilted, and how this artist's life is forever changed by that and his work. There's an interesting backstory to the book as well. It was given a state arts grant, but after it was completed, the grant was withdrawn because it was viewed as attacking the legitimacy of the Singaporean government. Because of the public kerfuffle around that, it became a huge bestseller. It's also a totally brilliant book, and I recommend everyone read it.
Whoa, that sounds so interesting. I didn't know anything about that.
Yeah, it's amazing. Charlie Chan Hock Chai, the main character, he might be crazy. He is definitely not rich. And the story that he tells of Singapore is really incredible and nuanced.
All right. Love to know about that. I would like to really go out on a limb and recommend that you read the novel that won the Pulitzer last year for Best Novel of the Year. This is the book Less by Andrew Sean Greer. It is a story about a gay man whose young lover of 9 years breaks up with him and pledges to marry a contemporary, and then invites our protagonist, Arthur Less, to the wedding. Arthur can't bear the thought of going and seeing the love of his life marry another. He can't bear the thought of staying home pouting and being gossiped about by everyone at the wedding, and thus decides to accept every invitation that has been extended to him to weird literary festivals and strange prizes and, you know, kind of bullshit travel writing assignments so that he can travel around the world for 9 months while he avoids the marriage of his former lover and also his impending 50th birthday party. So I didn't know anything about this novel except the loose outlines of the plot, and upon reading it was really struck by the type of book it is, which is not the type of book that I think of as being a Pulitzer-winning book, because it reads like light romantic fiction. It reads, honestly, like the sort of book that if it were written by a female author about a heterosexual relationship instead of entanglements, might have been not totally considered in the Pulitzer camp, not because just because of the way such work is classified. And I think this book is absolutely deserving of every prize and really profound and fascinating, because one of the things that it does is put an aging gay man at the center of the story and then interrogate what romance and aging mean for a group of people who, you know, for a few generations very rarely and seldomly got to experience aging because of AIDS, and for whom the romantic possibilities and options have complicated and expanded because of the expansion of marriage rights. So it takes this kind of light comedic touch and tone, the sort that doesn't have like weighty doorstop, I'm a serious novel temperament forged into the prose, but does something incredibly profound and beautiful in this light comedic style. And I love it. And I'm just like dying to talk about it with everybody a year late. So I would hope that all podcast listeners will read it and then we can start a year late national conversation about this book. Have you read it?
I have not. But, you know, yesterday I was at Books Are Magic, my neighborhood bookstore, and it is flying off the shelves there. Literally every person who is buying books at that bookstore, except for me, was buying a copy of it. They were placing it in everyone's hand. Everyone there loves that book. Everyone I know who's read it adores it.
I think it's really good. You'll find links to some of the things we talked about today on our show page at slate.com/culturefest, and you can email us at culturefest@slate.com or drop us a note on Facebook at facebook.com/culturefest. Our producer is Benjamin Frisch. Our production assistant is Alex Barish. For Isaac Butler and Ingu Kang, I'm Julia Turner, and we'll see you soon.